Hey, everybody, it's Sunny. Just wanted to give you a heads up. We've got a Bulwark Live event September 5th in Dallas. I hope everybody shows up. It's going to be fun. Adam Kinzinger is going to be there, a very special guest. Tim Miller, Sarah Longwell, Bill Crystal, myself. I'm going to be sitting in for JVL for a TNL taping. It's going to be fun, I think. I think people are going to have a good time. Again, it's in Dallas. It's at the Wiley Theater, which is very, very fancy. We have the fanciest places that we go play. But it's going to be a good time. And then on the 6th and the 7th, a bunch of folks are going down to Austin for the Tribune Fest. I'll be there on the 6th. There's a meet and greet after Sarah's panel, but it's going to be a good time. Come to that as well. So Dallas, September 5th, Austin, 6th and 7th. We're making a swing through Texas. It's very exciting, and I hope to see you guys there. Hope you also enjoy this episode of Across the Movie Aisle. Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm great. I missed you guys.
Oh, I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and controversies, Joaquin Phoenix has bailed on Todd Haynes' latest movie. It's described as focusing on an intense gay romance set in the 1930s, just days before filming was set to begin, leading to the project being scrapped entirely. Adding to everyone's confusion here in this whole situation is that the project originated with Phoenix, who brought it to Haynes and his producing partner, Christine Vachon, and worked on the screenplay with John Raymond. The explicit sex scenes in the film were likely to earn it an NC-17 or equivalent in the streaming era, which means that it's kind of surprising that this was going to be made at all. But, you know, Joaquin Phoenix, he's a star. People like to make movies with stars. That star power is going to be bolstered this fall by Joker, Folie à Deux. It's hitting theaters later this year. So that helps secure, you know, funding and insurance and all that stuff. There are a number of different threads or kind of ideas we can tug at here. On the one hand, you have an artist making a choice that might be best for him and his process in his own mental state, right? Joaquin Phoenix is always often talked about not being super comfortable with certain parts of acting and, you know, the promotion and all that stuff. You know, artists, they can be flighty. Sometimes they get spooked. But again, he's the one who brought the project to Haynes. If he didn't want to do this, he maybe should have worked on something else or handed it off to somebody else. And then there's, you know, the suggestion that Phoenix shouldn't have been cast in this project at all because he's not gay. Vachon shot that down in a post on Facebook. She reminded people that Phoenix is the one who originated in the first place and that Haynes, of all people, has a great record of working with gay actors, crew, you know, directors, nurturing careers, et cetera, et cetera. Frankly, I've never really bought into that line of argument. Actors should act in whatever role they feel they're best at. You know, it's pretending to be somebody else means pretending to be lots of different aspects of them, including their sexuality sometimes. My big criticism of Phoenix here is the most basic one imaginable, which is just that this is a horribly unprofessional thing to do. Don't leave people hanging like this. Like, it's work. Go do your job. If you don't want to do your job, don't initiate the project. People are out of work. You know, people have projects lined up. They're not going to be able to do them now. It's a real mess. It's a real mess. So the question now is what sort of repercussions Phoenix is going to face. In the short term, it's going to dampen any award season enthusiasm for his work in the new Joker movie. Remember, he did win an Oscar for his work in the first. In the medium term, it's hard to imagine he'll be insurable, particularly on some of the more daring indie stuff he likes to do. And as a reminder, we talk about insurance here. It's not like health insurance. You know, stars acquire what amounts to completion insurance, basically, which covers the cost of production if they get injured or otherwise become incapacitated and thus unable to finish the production, which is what secures the bond to get the funds for them. Whatever. The point is, actors get something called insurance. It's basically a backstop for financial loss in case something like this happens. He probably will have a harder time getting that insurance from now on. Alyssa, what is Phoenix's problem here? But like, really, what should we be looking at? What should we be talking about with this story? Because it's a big deal to have an actor of this caliber just kind of back out of something at the last minute. Not necessarily even for the world of film fans, but for the world of film production. Like, you can't have an industry that works when guys like Phoenix have this much power and then just say, like, I don't want to do it.
Yeah, I feel sort of reticent here just because I feel like it seems to me like there must be something going on that has not yet been reported. So I feel like I don't understand the entire scenario yet. I feel like one aspect of this that has not really been discussed is how we think about sort of actors and sex scenes and sort of figuring out consent and comfort, especially when it comes to men, right? I mean, a lot of the conversations about sort of intimacy coordinators, about, you know, sort of what actors have been willing to do or have felt pressured to do, has centered around women, right? And I do wonder if this was a situation with an actress who was walking away from a movie where she was expected to do some intense sex scenes, if the conversation would be a little different. Obviously, this is all made different by the fact that from all the reporting that we have, Phoenix was really sort of the driving factor behind this movie. There's been some reporting that he was, in fact, pushing for the sex scenes to be more explicit, or more, I think the word was maybe adventurous. And so, again, I mean, this story is all so sort of confusing that I feel like it's difficult for me to say definitively what should have happened. But I do wonder if that is one aspect of it. Like, how do we deal with it if someone decides that they're not comfortable performing a certain kind of sex scene that might be integral to a movie, legitimately might be integral to a movie, and that someone freaks out about? Because I do think performing sex scenes does create a different kind of permanent record, right? It's a different kind of vulnerability. I'm not saying that it is, you know, I don't want to say that it's sort of a question of degree, but it certainly is a question of difference, right? And agreeing to have yourself filmed doing certain things is kind of irrevocable, especially if you're doing it literally for public consumption and money. Do I think it's a good idea to make the decision 5 days before filming? Like, obviously not. But I do just want to keep open the possibility that this is a conversation that would be a little different if we were talking about a woman.
So, I think that's sort of true in the sense that all of us, maybe not all of us, I think we would have a different way of thinking about this if, for example, Emma Stone had backed out of Poor Things and we saw the final cut and we were like, with a different actress, doesn't matter who, totally irrelevant, with a different actress, and it was essentially the same movie, but it didn't have Emma Stone in it. And right, and all of us would have said, you know what, I that seems kind of reasonable, like, even if at the very end of the, yeah, okay, like, just like to become uncomfortable with it. Now, I also would have said the thing that I'm going to say here next, which is you have a contractual obligation. The point to back out is before you sign the contract.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that.
Every film that has that kind of nudity and that kind of sex in it is quite clear about this. In addition, this was not just a contractual obligation. This was Joaquin Phoenix's idea. Yeah, and he 100%. Was, as far as we know, we have no evidence that he was uncomfortable with the sex scenes. In fact, we have some reporting, again, it's a little unclear, that he might have actually pushed to make them more explicit and more intense and more revealing or something along those lines, right? He was there for the sex scenes, is the reporting. Something else happened here. I don't know what it was, but here's a story that I think people are forgetting. Ridley Scott has talked about making Napoleon with Joaquin Phoenix, and Ridley Scott said that, you know, it's a very star-centric movie, and it's also got a quite unusual performance and a sort of take on Napoleon at the center of it by Joaquin Phoenix. And Ridley Scott has said that something like a week or 2 weeks before production on that movie started, Joaquin Phoenix called him and was like, I'm not sure about this. I don't know. I just don't feel like I have any handle on this. I'm very uncomfortable. I'm very, like, just got weird about it and was like, not... Ridley Scott did not say the words he thought was thinking about backing out, but he did suggest strongly that Phoenix just really didn't feel like what was coming, like he was ready for it or anything like that. And so he said, so Scott dropped his, what he was doing for pre-production and all the stuff that he normally would be doing, a very intense schedule as a director. And was like, so I went and just sat with him for a day or two. And all we did was work out the character. We just worked out the character and worked out the character and worked out the character. And I got him comfortable with this role because that needed to happen. And so that to me suggests that there is just a history here of someone who gets right up to the line of filming. And as an artist, as a creative person, as somebody who is putting themselves out there, does not like gets a kind of jitters in their stomach and gets a kind of cold feet, gets an anxiety about it, doesn't feel like they have it in their head and is maybe making motion. Like it seems like, again, Ridley Scott did not say he was threatened to back out. So I am inferring that there was like a great anxiety here. If Ridley Scott was going to take a full day or two right before production, which is about the most intense time before you get on set, to work this out with his star. And the other thing is that's in keeping with what we know about Phoenix, which is he's an odd guy. He's a great actor. And these things are often both true. He's an odd guy. And I don't know his like personal psychology. You know, I've never like, as obviously like don't know him or like know people who know him or anything. But like he just comes across as an odd guy. Somebody who takes the acting part of this very seriously, but also has
some stuff.
Unusual stuff going on in his head, which is how you get some of these performances out of him. And so it's my suspicion to the, you know, again, I am inferring from a bunch of things here is that he just got way too in his own head about this. And at the last minute was like, I can't do it because he didn't have it. He didn't have it there. It was all a mess in his head and he was not ready. And this is not even actors who we think of as like much more kind of, I don't know, normal-ish people get pretty in their heads about their characters. It's an intense not every actor, but can. I remember reading an interview with Christian Bale who just talked about like the excessive prep that he does because he said he wants to walk on a set and know that he can give a director absolutely anything that the director asks for from that character, not just what's on the page. So the director should just be able to invent something right there in the moment on the day of filming. And Christian Bale says, I need to have the whole character, the entire life, you know, birth to death, every bit of that person in me at all times. And so I go way overboard in terms of creating that in my head in advance. And it's a lot and it's intense, but that means that when I get on set, I know that I will be prepared for anything. Actors do a lot of like weird, intense in their head stuff. And frankly, I've worked with great writers who I think we've probably all had this experience to some degree, like as editors, because we all work as editors with writers who are very good, but like, and you know, they produce great stuff. You know that their copy is good, you know, and that like the day before the deadline, you get a call and it's like, I don't know, this is a disaster. What's going on? Right. And you just have to talk them through. And this is just part of the creative process. I think it's mostly not okay to pull out of a project like this. It is mostly not okay. Like I both get it because sometimes you just can't, but also like you agree to do this. You are the centerpiece of a lot of people's livelihoods. And if you feel uncomfortable, get comfortable. Your job is to get comfortable because you agreed to do that. And you agreed to do it so in a way that other people put their money and their time and their livelihoods on the line. And this is not just rich producers. This is a bunch of below the line talent who are not superstars and they are out of work now. And that is the practical implication here. And that's just totally unfair. I'm sorry if you feel a little uncomfortable with this. Like call Todd Haynes and say, I feel uncomfortable. Let's figure out how to make this more comfortable. But don't say I'm done. I'm out. I'm just not doing it. Joaquin Phoenix is rich and a movie star. He can afford to, but the below the line talent, they cannot.
Well, this is essentially where I come down, right? Is that like, I understand having to work through your process and I understand
You have a right to be weird, kind of. Like, if you are that kind of star.
I'm willing to defend a lot of actorly weirdness. I don't care what they do behind the scenes. What I care about is what's on the screen. But, like, this is a situation where lots of people are out lots of... I mean, like, not millions of dollars for the most part, probably, but lots of people are out their salary for weeks and months. They're out the stuff they need to get done to qualify for health insurance for their unions. You know, I have no patience for this kind of behavior, just because it does affect lots of other people's lives in very real ways. And like Alyssa says, I'm curious to see if there's more that comes out about this, if there are things we learn, you know, that were going on behind the scenes, that there was a real conflict between, you know, Haynes and Phoenix about what they wanted to do or what they wanted to show.
Or again, if there's something else going on with Phoenix that's, you know, sort of, I don't know.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, it would depend on what is going on with him. I mean, it'd be one thing if he has, like, he's got cancer.
Yes, I will retract at least to some degree my you have a responsibility to get this movie made if there is some sort of major health, like real physical health issue that like that potentially prevents him, where he's got to be in, you know, like in a hospital type treatment here, and he just doesn't want to tell people that, which is a possibility, I guess.
Sure.
Hinting of that. We are totally speculating about that sort of thing, to be clear.
There are possibilities, but like I really think he has a responsibility to make people whole here to the best that he can. And the good news is he's about to get paid $20 million for Joker, so maybe he can do that. But I just have no patience.
Probably a lot more than $20 million once you factor in the fact that like points, he almost certainly is going to get points on a movie that's going to do big business. I mean, just go back to the Scarlett Johansson fight with Disney over Black Widow, where, you know, the lawsuit was over the fact that or the argument made by her and her legal team that if that movie had been released in theaters the normal way, and let's sort of, this was COVID, so it's complicated, but that like her end would have totaled something closer to $50 million. And Joker 2 is maybe not a $50 million actor movie, but like the points on these things add up a lot in addition to a very big upfront payment for these folks.
So what do we think? Is that a controversy or a non-controversy that Phoenix bailed on his new film with such short notice, Peter?
Yeah, of course it's a controversy. Maybe there's a good reason for this, but we sure haven't heard it. And everything we have heard suggests that there's not a good reason. And Phoenix, this is not appropriate.
Alyssa.
It's controversial, even if there is a good reason for it. It's a, you know, odd decision in a major story about one of the most significant actors in Hollywood right now, leading into another Oscar season for him. Something's going on and it's weird.
Controversy. Be better, folks. Don't. I don't know. Hopefully nothing is seriously wrong with him. I want to emphasize that because we don't know the whole story here. It's entirely possible that something really comes out, but that's not the sense that has been circulating from some of the interviews and some of the social media posts from, you know, like the producer, Christine Bashaw. It seems everyone seemed kind of blindsided by it and not in a, oh my God, we hope he's okay sort of way. So we'll see. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode on the Olympics. We're going to be talking about the Olympics presentation on Peacock, which was an enormous win, I think, for Peacock. Just a great all-around thing. Streaming, it's finally hitting its own kind of. The future's here, maybe. We'll see. All right. Now on to the main event. Speaking of streaming, The Instigators. It's streaming now on Apple TV Plus. The Instigators stars Matt Damon and Casey Affleck as Rory and Cobby, a hapless pair of Boston goons attempting to pull off an election night theft. Not of ballots, mind you. Now they're not stealing any votes here, but of illegal campaign contributions to corrupt Democratic Mayor Maselli, who's played by Ron Perlman, the great Ron Perlman. Accompanying Rory and Cobby are Rory's psychiatrist, Dr. Donna Rivera. She's played by Hong Chow, who is half hostage, kind of half, I don't know, mental health care provider. The heist was set up by
Shrink co-conspirator.
The mastermind of this is played by Michael Stuhlbarg, and Alfred Molina plays his right-hand man. And I'm just rattling off names here because I need you to know the best thing about this film from Doug Liman is that he just has a cavalcade of guys I like seeing on screen, right? I haven't even mentioned Paul Walter Hauser, who shows up for like two scenes. I'm getting there, Alyssa. He's set up to be a whole thing. And then you got Ving Rhames, who plays a corrupt cop slash enforcer. He's hot on the heels of Rory and Cobby. It's just wonderful. It's wonderful seeing all these guys around. And you want to see more of them. It lends it the sense of being sort of a pseudo hangout picture almost. And in that way, The Instigators is aces. Damon is charming. He's always a natural star. And Affleck's humor has always been kind of inflected with an interesting wry annoyance. Like he can't believe the mess he's found himself in. And Affleck, he's been kind of quiet in recent years. There was a sexual harassment lawsuit stemming from his work with Joaquin Phoenix during the making of the mockumentary I'm Not Here that received renewed interest during the peak of the Me Too movement. You know, everyone was like, oh, wait, this Casey Affleck, he's a bad guy. So he went away for a little while, but he was back last year in Oppenheimer. He was really good as the hero of the film, Colonel Pash. And his work here is more charming, right? He's a solidly pestering little brother energy having sort of guy, which has always been kind of how he fits in with Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. And I like that dynamic. The politics of this film are kind of interesting, at least in the sense that it's a film about corruption and how no one is really immune to it, even the go-getting change agents, not entirely immune to it. And it's also firmly ensconced in the world of democratic machine politics, thanks to its Boston setting. And this is very much a Boston movie. I think Alyssa's going to talk a bit about that more in a bit. You know, they're just dropping names like Quincy and Walpole and Lynn. Everyone's dropping their eyes. It's real nice. I like it. I like having a little bit of regional filmmaking here. I guess what I'm saying is this is a perfectly acceptable 100 minutes of streaming movie. It's charming, but not particularly memorable. It's funny. I couldn't tell you any of the jokes in it. It's got lots of nice performances with a bunch of people I like seeing on screen. I feel like director Doug Liman has secretly peppered this film with lots of cinematic riffs and references, right? Like Ving Rhames shows up on the screen and you see him from behind and I'm pretty sure he's got a Band-Aid on the back of his head, which of course is a Pulp Fiction riff. Or like the way the movie shifts very pointedly to like a shaky handheld cam during the car chase sequences, which calls to mind Liman's work with Damon on the Bourne movie, the first Bourne movie.
There's explicitly a reference to the Thomas Crown Affair, the original, which of course is a bank robbery movie that was shot in and around the Boston area, mostly at South Boston, but also some scenes in Salem. I mean, it's
there's a literal quotation of The Wire.
Yes,
there's a quotation of The Wire. See, now I'm starting to remember all of them. There's a quotation of The Wire, and they also call themselves the nicknames of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Longbaugh and Parker, I think. Is that anyway, there's a whole bunch of these little things kind of going throughout. It's a movie where it really feels like the director and the actors are all having probably more fun, frankly, than we are watching at home. They seem to be having a pretty good time together. And I'm not saying I wasn't having fun watching this at home. It's amusing enough. It's fine. Again, perfect streaming fare, which is saying something. That's, you know, that's a thing. Peter, what did you make of The Instigators?
It's very good streaming fare. It is better than average, I think. This is certainly much better than something like a Red Notice or whatever that Gal Gadot action movie that
Heart
on Netflix. Heart of Stone. Yes, that
I did not watch that.
I don't know whether I watched that movie. I have no idea.
I think I had it on our schedule at some point with like Heart of Stone.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know, right? But it's definitely better than Beverly Hills Cop 4, which I didn't even hate. But like, this is actually pretty good, despite not being all that good. And the thing is that it's like incredibly charming, and even despite being It's like both incredibly charming and kind of mediocre in its execution, but it's just elevated at every moment by having all of these fantastic actors on screen. And you can just tell that they are enjoying themselves, that there is probably some improv here, but like the little tiny moments are all written reasonably well, I shouldn't say all, but many of them are written really pretty well, and they're written pretty well, and then they're acted very well. And this is, I think, the difference, right? That like this is just not that great a movie, but it's good enough because all of the kind of craft work, and I mean that in terms of the star acting, I mean that in terms of like the little turns of phrase and the slight pauses and curlicues in the conversation, just the way that drunk Casey Affleck seems to be sort of bumbling through everything, but also like constantly questioning what the hell is going on in a kind of direct way that's very funny. The willingness to be a little bit broken and shitty on Affleck's part in particular, but also Matt Damon's part, right? Like they're not playing perfect people who have no flaws, or their only flaw is they don't realize that they think they have a flaw, but actually they don't realize, right? Like these are kind of broken people. Okay, they're also very handsome, like movie stars on screen doing fun things and not getting themselves into real trouble. But they're kind of broken people in a way that makes you actually root for them. And that is a real lesson in screenwriting that I don't want to say has been totally forgotten, but far too many movies, especially in the superhero era, forget to give their protagonists like something like a real problem or something like a real personal flaw. And this movie starts from that. Starts from these people are flawed, but you know what? We're all flawed and we all want something in life. And just because you're kind of a screw up doesn't mean that we don't want you to win. And so you root for these characters and you enjoy spending time with them. And then you have all of these other supporting characters who are just great. Like, why is Alfred Molina in this movie? I have no idea. But every scene with him is delightful. I'm always happy to see Alfred Molina just sort of shaggily bumming around. And then also especially when he's shaggily bumming around with Michael Stuhlbarg, right? And it's just like, I now want to see the movie that's just the two of them planning heists and hiring idiots off the streets of Boston. And it always goes wrong. And like, we find out why Michael Stuhlbarg has a house that's nothing but boxes of audio gear, right? Like, did you guys notice every box in that house where he's like, it's like Technics turntables and JVC receivers and like, Magnavox speakers, right? It's just all audio. Like, why? Okay, it's funny, right? We don't know why. Maybe it's funnier that we'll never find out. So I found this movie, it's much better than it needed to be. It's much better than a lot of the comparison movies. Like, there was a Mark Wahlberg Boston movie that came out on one of these streamers that came out a couple of, Patriots like a year Day? Or two ago. No. It was a comic hijinks adventure movie that I think we even did on this podcast.
We did do an episode. It's the one that
directed,
was like a remake.
By the same guy who did Battleship and...
It's not Argyle. It's another single name.
We've all forgotten this movie because it was totally forgettable. And Mark Wahlberg also did that that dad spy movie, right, earlier this year. And it's just, these things are forgettable. This one is a little forgettable, but I'll remember bits from it. And I'll remember those bits because the actors are enjoying themselves, but also showing up to work. And the one I want to single out before I finish here and turn this over to Alyssa is Ron Perlman, because Ron Perlman is always good, but he's especially good in this because he is a Frenchman doing a Boston accent as like a reasonably good, if not perfectly precise, reasonably good and super entertaining Boston accent.
To be fair, it's not that hard to pack a cat in the Havignard, Peter. I mean, really.
Wait. Did you say that Ron Perlman is a Frenchman?
Isn't he?
No, he's very American.
Ron Perlman started doing French language films with Jean-Pierre Jeunet in like City of Lost Children. That
I don't
was
know what to tell
from.
You. He was born in Manhattan.
Washington Heights, specifically.
Oh, man. Okay, well, fine. Then he's a guy who started out doing French movies.
This is like saying Clint Eastwood is Italian. Clint Eastwood.
Whatever.
All right, spaghetti western.
I retract.
Star.
I retract my. In any case, it's
take
delightful.
It back. You take it back. You do
I'm
not
sorry.
Besmirch Ron
it's
Perlman
a less impressive,
by describing him as a
right.
Frenchman.
It's a less impressive performance than I said. No, I loved it. I just love Ron Perlman. Is all I'm trying to say. And again, you can just imagine spin-off movies for basically all of these characters that are fun, and. Like watching Ron Perlman hang out with Toby Jones and do like corrupt Boston Democratic, you know, machine politics stuff like for a couple hours. I'd have. Yeah. OK, sign me up. I want to watch the whole universe of spinoffs from this. Right. In the like the Cheers cast kind of way.
It's definitely I agree with most all of what you said. I will say it is one of the. Lazily plotted is the wrong word exactly, but it's very perfunctory
absolutely.
In its plotting. There's like a literal get out of jail free card at the end of it.
This
like,
is why I said that the small craft work is what elevates this movie. It's like the screenplay is good in the sense of many of the lines are good and the scenes have been polished better than they need to be. Structurally, it's like, we just need these scenes to happen.
Definitely a feeling to this movie like there's stuff that got kind of chopped out in editing and nobody really thought about how to smooth it over. Like, I still don't quite understand how Matt Damon's character ends up in this in the first place. Like, it's not totally clear to me how he knows Kavi. Like, there's something missing in that sort of initial plot architecture that's a little strange.
Yes, I would. Yeah, I have questions, but this is fine. Alyssa, what did you make of this specifically as a Boston movie? You're from Boston. You're from
so to
up
be
there.
To be totally clear, because it will be for reasons that will become clear as I explain this. I was not born in the Boston area, but my family moved there almost 30 years ago. And so I grew up in the area, spent a lot of time there, and. You know, have been there. My family has been there during an era when the region changed a lot. You know, part of what is interesting about this movie is that it does reflect a real shift in Boston proper away from a sort of Irish-dominated political machine, last represented by Matty Walsh, who is the Biden administration's, who was Secretary of Labor, now runs the National Hockey League. And I think was actually a very good mayor, was not corrupt in the way the mayor is described here. But his predecessor, Michelle Wu, is the first woman, first Asian to be elected, Asian American to be elected mayor of Boston. She has been very progressive. And there has been a sense that, you know, she is kind of running things in a new and fresh way. She's also very young. She's my age or a year younger than me, I think. And so, you know, the movie with its transition from sort of an Irish political machine to, you know, a younger Asian American reform candidate does reflect, you know, a real sort of shift in Boston proper. And it's also a reflection, you know, Boston has always had sort of a stark town-gown divide, right? I mean, it is a city with, you know, working class, not just sort of the Irish working class population that we always see in movies, but a, you know, a poor Black population, and then it has always had these huge and important research universities, sort of most importantly, Harvard and MIT. And those institutions are important to the region, not just because they're great schools and because, you know, people like to talk about them and get excited about them, but because especially through their purchases of real estate and their developments of the biomedical industries, they have really transformed the region in a way that has intensified some of those disparities. You know, Harvard has just huge, you know, real estate and economic developments. It has completely transformed one side of the Charles River in this neighborhood known as Alston. Boston has become, you know, a much more prominent sort of like biomedical center of biomedical research. You know, the like Moderna, which developed one of the COVID vaccines, is based up there and comes out of research from the region. It's also become a huge financial center. And it's a region where the development of housing in particular has really not kept pace with that, you know, that increasing affluence. So you have, you know, really, really brutal housing pressures, really stark rich poor divides in a lot of the regions. You know, the Lexington, the town that I grew up in, you know, has become just like a radically different place in the time since my family moved there. Bill McKibben, who the environmental activist who grew up in Lexington, not that far from where I lived, has actually sort of written a book about the town as an example of kind of liberal hypocrisy in some ways. And that's, you know, that's something that is very important to the region, not sort of a full spectrum that frequently shows up in the Boston movies that are very ubiquitous in a lot of ways. And it's kind of interesting that Matt Damon is in this movie, which does capture sort of some of that divide, if not in great detail, given that he also, you know, sort of came to fame in one of the last movies to really capture some of that town gown divide, Good Will Hunting, in which, you know, he plays a working class kid who has a shot at, you know, getting into one of these educational institutions. And so, you know, this movie is interesting in the sense that it's clearly inspired by the transition from Walsh to Wu and the, you know, the mayoralty. It does have this sense of sort of regional variation and very strong kind of town identities. The jokes about like the police forces from a bunch of the different surrounding states converging on the cities is very funny, especially considering that Massachusetts has kind of absurd laws about things for which you have to pay, like you have to pay cops overtime or like hire off-duty cops to do. So you have a bunch of very, very rich cops. Like there are always a couple of cops who are among the most highly paid state employees in Massachusetts. And so the idea of that, those like jurisdictional clashes are funny. I think the problem though is that like saying that like, you know, the moment when Hong Chau's character, Casey Affleck's character, asks her where she's from, and she thinks it's sort of an insult about the fact that she's Asian American. She's like, I'm from Lynn. And he goes, figures. And like, that's kind of funny if you live there, but the movie doesn't do enough to establish those like very intense sort of micro identities. That
granted, that would be difficult, right?
Like, it would totally be difficult.
I only got that because I've spent some time in the Boston area, about 10 minutes from Lynn this summer, and I have a sense of like what it's like to be from Lynn, but I wouldn't have even 2 years ago.
I'll defend it. I'll defend it in the sense that I have no knowledge. I've actually never even been to Boston. It's like one of the few major American cities I haven't been to. Never been. No desire.
There's
to
an
go.
Alamo it's, here. Let's do a gross. Live show.
Gross. It's full of people who can barely stand because they're too drunk and sorry.
No, we're all hopped up on Dunkin' Donuts. Can I just say it's incredibly funny that Jack Harlow, who has a small role in this movie, is also in the like Dunkin' Donuts Dunkings video, music video with Ben Affleck.
We can get into the artist equity of all this in a minute because I do kind of think of these movies as work projects for Ben Affleck and Matt Damon and their friends, which is, I think, at least part of the explanation as to how Michael Stuhlbarg and, you know, what's his name?
Alfred Molina.
Alfred Molina shows up for
like
nothing.
Let's get Doc Ock, except he runs a donut shop. And
it's not a donut
crimes.
Shop. It's an Italian bakery.
When
savage.
Ving Rhames walks in, he literally says, I just make the donuts.
And okay, but it's like clearly a, you know, it's like an Italian bakery. Come on.
My point is, I will defend the script. I'll defend the Lynn line in the script because it is it gets at a very specific thing that we're talking about here, which is the idea of interregional differences. If yes. I like was talking about a snooty rich person in Dallas and was like, yeah, it makes sense that you're from Highland Park. That would make sense, but you wouldn't have to understand that like, that's the nice part of Dallas, right? You would just be like, okay, it's a regional specificity that works in the general.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. I will just say that if you know the area, you will understand it even more.
But I will also say it would have been an even better joke if it was Lexington, Belmont, Newton, Concord, or Carlisle.
See, but that doesn't, it wouldn't actually work any better.
It does not land better as a Swampscott joke.
It's the same joke. It's the same joke. I don't know any of those things. I don't know what any of those cities, those could be the worst or the best parts of Boston. It wouldn't matter. What matters is the context within the movie.
Those are separate towns. If you want to talk about like neighborhoods, then it's like, you know.
See, this is the narcissism of small differences. You are like all had, and like I'm like, no, this works fine.
Oh,
as
you think
a general,
you think there's small differences.
They're all the same. Everybody from Boston is exactly the same. They all sound like Ben Affleck from The Town. I mean, it's like they're all Jeremy Renner looking out to beat up a guy. I don't know. It's fine. All right. So as a Boston movie, though, Alyssa, do you get thumbs up or thumbs down?
Oh, thumbs up. I think this is quite enjoyable. I really like, I am continue to be curious about sort of editing and what the original screenplay for this looked like, because it just feels like there are chunks of it that are kind of missing.
There's some version of this that's 15 minutes longer.
Yeah.
This is an hour and 57 minute movie, not an hour and 41 or whatever this is.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it's highly enjoyable. I wish they'd done like a little bit more with the geography of the city, although the idea of like robbing the wharf that way is pretty funny. It would have been even funnier if they'd had the party at like the Boston Aquarium. But, you know, beggars can't be choosers. Like, you could have had some, you know, some sea lion jokes, whatever.
But they already built a whole movie around the Boston Aquarium. It's called Next Stop Wonderland.
Yes,
and it's a delight.
I'm pro
100 minutes for this movie. I don't think this movie needs to be any longer than it is.
I think that's probably true. I'm just like, I feel like there are even just a couple of exchanges that would have filled in the relationships a little bit more.
Context is overrated.
It doesn't necessarily matter. It's highly enjoyable. I kind of want to watch it again. It's like a perfect sick day movie. I want to watch it when like I don't have the energy to concentrate too much.
The thing I really want to actually do is just sit down and catalog all of the very specific references that are going on in this movie, because I do think that there's like there was an in joke on set that there had to be one reference to something in every scene. And I feel like we're just like you, Peter, you mentioned all the boxes of, you know, sound gear. And I guarantee you that's a reference to some movie we are not thinking of or have not.
Or it's just that the stuff is stolen and he's a criminal and he has a bunch of stolen sound equipment.
What was Alfred Molina's sound gear in Boogie Nights? Was it all the stuff
it's
that's
been
in those boxes?
Since I've seen that one, my friend.
I bet it was. No, but like it's, you know. I bet there was something. Anyway.
Also, it was Don Cheadle who was the hi-fi salesman.
God.
Well, yeah, but I'm not talking about the hi-fi salesman. I'm talking about Alfred Molina in his drug den where he's playing the song on his wife on his hi-fi.
I remember his hi-fi system because that movie has 70s hi-fi as a like through line all the way, right? Like with Don Cheadle trying to convince people that it's worth it. And then it turns out who believes it's worth it? The Alfred Molina character, right? That's so good. Hi-fi is great.
Do you collect vintage audio equipment?
I don't have space for it, so not really. I have a little bit of stuff.
We're not doing this. All right. What do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Instigators? Peter.
I enjoyed this much more than I should. A thumbs up. It's like a thumbs up for a movie that if I had to rate like on a scale of like 1 to 10, I think I'd probably only give like a 5.9, but I also really enjoyed it.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up. It's way more fun than I expected it to be.
Thumbs up. Fun movie. Fun streaming. Just sitting at home doing nothing movie. That's what all movies should aim for, frankly. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.